Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled here on the My View Matters Radio Network. I am your host, Ken Molman, and this week I am ill. I've got the oh-so-scary virus that the news made a big deal out of. I think I made fun of that on a previous show about how they didn't even tell you what the symptoms were until paragraph 22 of the story. But I do have that virus. I'm okay. I'm not going to die, but I don't know that I can get through a full hour of talking through the show, and so I figured it was just better to go ahead and do a best of this week, and next week I know we'll have some great news to talk about, and specifically revolving around me, and some other things that I do, but until then, folks, please enjoy this best of show. I apologize again for it, but again, I'm sick, so I don't think I can make it through a full show in the condition I'm in, and we do have good clips from previous shows that you should take a listen to if you've missed them before. And otherwise, we'll hear from you next week. And folks, until next week, have a good week and enjoy this best of show. But before I go, I will give you all a new bit of political, random political rhetoric because, you know, who wants recycled political rhetoric? We need new political rhetoric. So this week's randomly generated political rhetoric is, unlike myself, my opponent wants an America where overpaid CEOs and smelly hippies can corrupt our hardworking teachers. Yes, it is silly, on purpose. And continuing our correlation-causation topic on the spurious correlations, and continuing off of last week's real source of the war on women, what we have found this week is that females in California who slipped or tripped to their death correlates with the sales of General Mills Corporation in billions of dollars from 2008 to 2010. So because you bought cereal, women died. Or those who would abuse statistics and use correlation as causation would, you know, have you believe. But again, the point is that correlation is not causation. They are different things, and it's important to know the difference. And now, folks, without further ado, here's the best of show. See you next week.
A company in Japan has developed glasses that stymie the facial recognition stuff that's becoming more and more prevalent. And I don't know if you guys have seen this. Those of you who use Facebook, it's kind of scary that Facebook is now prompting me when I see a picture of someone with my friend in it to tag my friend. And it knows exactly who they are, and it knows exactly where they are. It's like, hey, would you like to tag them? And it's like, well, wait a second. Why are you asking me to do it? You already know they're there. I mean, is that just to make you feel a little less big brotherish that, you know, you're prompting other people to tag people in photos? Or what's the deal? I mean, that's kind of weird that you know who they are, and boy, is that uncomfortable. I mean, I think that's really kind of over the line. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I'm not real comfortable with Facebook and Google and all these things doing the facial recognition stuff on photos, and I think that that's not good for privacy. And I don't know. I mean, it just doesn't – just kind of weirds me out. I don't know you all, but – I'm not a big fan of it at all. Anyway, a company in Japan has come up with some glasses that screw with the facial recognition software that's out there. And essentially what it does, and this is kind of silly, it puts out light from a almost infrared, or at an almost infrared band of light, and makes it so that the normal person wouldn't see this light on, but the facial recognition software would pick it up because it's picture, and it'll mess it up because it's got this extra light and it's just distorting the picture that it's looking at. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and I'm going to have to look into this a little more. I think that that should be that could be a very interesting project to take on and see about, you know, for those who wear glasses and a possibility of, you know, somehow sneaking those in there so they don't look so goofy, because this design, I mean, it looks really funny. If you've ever seen in basketball, when the basketball players have those big safety goggles on, I don't know how else to explain them, but they're big safety goggle-looking things. That's essentially what this looks like right now. It's a big safety goggles-looking thing with a bunch of lights in it. So I think that some improvements going to be needed to the design to make it so it's not so weird-looking. But I think it is anything we can do to try to protect our privacy, I think, is a good thing. I don't feel comfortable with all these facial recognition softwares and all this. I just think that it's a very big problem with all of it. Anyway, moving on. Last week we talked about the parties. We talked about third parties. We talked about a number of things, and I didn't get to quite all the material. We ran out of time, and I wanted to get to some of that, and because some of it's a little bit more general. We talked about the Virginia governor's race. There's been even more numbers that have come out that pretty much definitively show that, the Republicans lost that race all on their own. And in fact, the Republican campaign isn't blaming the Libertarian for his loss. What he's blaming for his loss is that the national GOP basically abandoned him. And, I think that to an extent that's true. If you look at the fundraising and you look at how the money came in, and this isn't off your election, or was rather, the Republican candidate just didn't bring in as much money as the Democrat candidate. And I don't know if I've ever shared this rule with you all in my audience, but I've done a lot of analysis of a lot of political races. I mean, I've looked at a lot of races. Not just because of my duties within the Libertarian Party, but just in general. I legitimately find it interesting that if I went back to school, I would like to go into political science. I really honestly find a lot of this stuff just genuinely interesting. And because politics, as I like to say, is policy and, I forgot my own quote. That's terrible. but essentially, it's a popularity contest with policy thrown in to boot. And it's interesting because with a strong enough message, you can get outspent by about 4-1 and still have a chance of winning. If your message is superior, and you're able to get it out there and articulate it, right? That's part of having a good message, is being able to articulate that message. If you can get that message out there with about 4, even being outspent 4-1, and if your opponent has a bad message or no message at all, other than this guy sucks, you should vote for me, which is a pretty common message in elections these days. If you have a strong enough message, you can get outspent by up to 4-1 and still have a chance of winning. Once you get outspent by more than 4-1, you're pretty much toast. And the reason is because at that point you're being flooded in the media and just overwhelmed. And the media is just full of you, of your opponent, getting drowned and lost in that. And that also ties into third-party, independent, libertarian, whatever candidate sees. When you're running in a three-way race or a four-way race, and the media has already kind of set the tone that two others are it, and the money just isn't there, which is funny because in part the reason the money isn't there is because the media has already set the tone. It's giant chicken and egg problems with the whole electoral system, and I'll go into that in a little bit here, but once you've set the tone, once the media has set the tone, it's very difficult to change the media and change its tone. They start saying it's this versus this, it's this versus this. The media set the tone in that Virginia governor's race that the Libertarian was going to cost the Republican the election. And in many ways, that's why there are still tons of people out there who really do believe that the Libertarian candidate made the GOP candidate lose. The reality is the Republican candidate did not have that strong of a message. Like I said, I watched that race for 4 months. And in the polls for the entire time, that entire 4 months, the Republican candidate sat at high 30 to low 40%. The Democratic candidate was in the low 40s to high 40s the entire time. And the Democrat was just about to cross over 50% when the Obamacare mess all kind of hit, which, you know, whatever. And the Democrats would take a hit, certainly. But what we saw is that those people were otherwise Democrat voters that went to the Libertarian candidate. We talked about this. Those votes would have never have gone to the Republican candidate. Those are people who would have otherwise either stayed home or would have held their nose and voted for the Democrat. And the real sad thing about that is that there were a lot of people. I mean, there was a newspaper that actually endorsed, even in the face of the fact, they knew that Sarvis could not win the Libertarian candidate in Virginia. They endorsed him anyway. Pretty powerful. Because the reality is, Sarvis actually would have, or had anyway, a better platform than the Republican and the Democratic candidates. So then it's a question of what's wrong? Why can't independent and third-party candidates win? And I think that what we're seeing now is a shift. And I talked to a Tea Party group this week about our electoral system and how we've gone through changes through time, how things have changed over time and why and what were the main things going on in different periods of history. And basically what they call these things is the party system. Starting from the signing of the Constitution forward, we've had basically five eras. And in each of the eras, there's different themes, there's different things that are going on. And it really wasn't until the beginning of what they call the third party system, the fourth party system, where ballot access rules and different things were changed. And there were some very fundamental changes to the way that we vote that occurred during that period. Previously, you saw candidates running under multiple tickets. So in other words, Bob Jones was running for office, and he may get the endorsement of three or four local parties in the area, whatever. You know, that was pretty common. That was no big deal, right? I mean, that was what they called fusion ticketing, where one candidate would receive more endorsements than just one party. And the reason is because when you used to go to the polls, there'd be people standing outside the polls with pieces of paper and say, hey, you should vote for our ticket. And you've heard the term straight ticket, of course. Well, a ticket used to be a literal piece of paper with a list of names. And what they would do, the paper would be a slightly different color or whatever, and you would go in and put it in the ballot box. And the term splitting the ticket meant that you tore someone out of your ticket, right? That's what splitting the ticket was. You fast forward to today when the exact opposite is true. Today, you have no one is allowed, right, to electioneer, as they call it, outside the polls. And that was done supposedly to end voter intimidation. You have this party ticket mechanism is just a button on the ballot now, the electronic ballot, rather than being some sort of piece of paper or whatever given to you by a party. So instead of a private party giving you a list or a suggestion list, it's now the government providing the means for that list. And you have it really a focus on party rather than individual candidates. I mean, we've moved a really long way away from where we started. And then on top of that, one of the things I would love to talk about is how the very first Congress, there were approximately 33,000 people, and I have to use that in quotes because the three-fifths clause was in effect then, which is horrible and whatever, but it is what it is. There were about 33,000 quote people that were represented by one U.S. representative. Today, that number is 725,000 people, 725,000 people. By contrast, or as a means of comparison, in the state Senate, excuse me, the state House, Kentucky State House, there are approximately 44,000 people per state House rep. So basically, today, House of Representatives is 33% less representative than the original United States Congress. Our United States Congress is more than, I'm not going to be able to do the math in my head, but about 25 times less representative than it was originally. And what that's done is it's made these races bigger. It's made them require more money. It's made them require, this is all stuff that came about over time, and it changed little by little over time. But it fundamentally changed what we had originally versus what we have now. And it's an important thing to know because people like to talk about the founding fathers. They like to talk about the things that we had and why are things, you know, we want to go back to the way they were. But no one's talking about the real core fundamental things that changed over time. And ironically, many times, the people talking about, you know, wanting to go back to the way it was are Republicans who oppose reforms that would put us back to where things were. Meanwhile, Democrats are the ones who, and not the parties, but their supporters, are often the ones talking about, you know, claiming their progressive ideas of making things more democratic and more representative, which really is moving us back towards where we came from. And it is kind of interesting and ironic. And the reality is there are a number of reforms that could be done. That are really nonpartisan that could really help the system. I mentioned last week we had an article, of op-ed, published in Forbes, about a Republican Party that can't win versus a Democratic Party that can govern. And I think in many, many ways, that's exactly how many people feel. Essentially, the policies, the talking points of many Republicans are not popular, and specifically the social conservatives who want to bring back draconian social restrictions. Yeah, well, you know, they say that kind of stuff, but that could never happen. Oh, yeah? Take a look at some of the Middle Eastern countries in the 50s and 60s. And then look what happened after they were taken over by extreme religious factions. It can happen. It absolutely can. So Republicans are not popular because of their social con stuff. And I really do think that's the main thing. I don't think it's – the Republican establishment likes to talk about the makers versus the takers and all that garbage. And that might be true to a limited extent, maybe. But quite honestly, I don't think that's the real problem. I think the real problem is that when you start running on a socially conservative platform, and not that there's anything wrong with being a social conservative personally. I am a social conservative personally. I live a socially conservative lifestyle. The difference, though, is that I don't run around trying to impose that on other people. Just because something works for me doesn't mean it works for everyone. And that's the key understanding that Republicans and Democrats both miss. Just because it's right for you doesn't mean you have the right to cram it down somebody else's throat. And I think more and more people are starting to realize this. I mean, again, the Republicans can't win. The Democrats can't govern. We're still in this recession. They're talking about more quantitative easing. We keep talking more and more. That's not going to work. And once again, you know, I started talking with somebody about inflation here. I guess it was at the Tea Party meeting about the inflation and the price of food. And honestly, I just honestly hadn't been shopping in a while. The wife takes care of that. And I was amazed to find out that prices are still going up. And, you know, the other side of it, what was kind of interesting, is that the size of the portions you're buying go down. You know, we had my youngest had a birthday party today. And we made some food for our guests, usually at the kind of a small summer gathering. And we made food, and one of the we made was meatballs. And my wife was surprised. You know, she just went and got the frozen meatballs and warmed them up in the crock pot. But she was surprised at how much smaller the packages of meatballs have become. I mean, it's not even been a year since we bought meatballs the last time. I don't know. I mean, things keep getting worse. And I honestly believe that in part the Republicans don't want to win. And I've had over and over and over. But I don't think the Republicans want to win. I think the establishment Republicans don't mind if they win. But the establishment Republicans don't want the Tea Party Republicans to win. Cuccinelli in Virginia, the Republican in Virginia's race, was not winning. He was running a typical Republican race. In the primary, apparently, he ran more as a Tea Party guy. When he got into the general, his advisors told him to run a more generic race. And so he was for a while. But what that did was it shook his core support. His core support were the Tea Party folks. And so he was getting money from the establishment until fired his campaign team. His campaign team were establishment folks, my understanding anyway. And once he fired them, the national money dried up. They basically said, okay, you're a Tea Party guy, you're done. We're not going to play ball. And we've seen the stories that have come out. I'm looking at one here from the Washington Times. I think this is from last week, a week and a half ago, about the GOP establishment declaring war on the Tea Party faction, and that the GOP is out raising money from the business community to primary the so-called Tea Party leaders in the House and Senate. Now, I knew this was coming, and I called this all along. And it's kind of funny because there were a lot of people, oh, no, they'd never do that. Really? Really? You not studied your history? But essentially now we have the establishment striking back against the Tea Party. Meanwhile, the Democrats, I don't even know what they're doing. Quite honestly, they don't seem to be doing squat. They seem to be completely paralyzed. Which gets back to that whole can't govern thing. It's amazing. It's amazing that more people aren't upset. That's what's amazing to me. We're in year five, almost year six of this recession now. Things still aren't better. Anybody knows it. Everybody knows it. From a individual wealth perspective, 95% or more of the country has moved backwards and continues to move backwards. Things aren't getting better. Things are not getting better. And I think that's why we're starting to see results like we saw in Virginia. I think that's why we're starting to see a rise in the number of independents, and not just a rise in independents, because that's been happening for a while, but a rise in the number of vocal, angry, and rightfully so angry, dependents. Whatever. Things aren't getting better. They're not. And now, as third parties and independents are poised to strike, poised to benefit, and understand it's a mutual beneficial thing, right? The third parties and independents are promising a new direction outside of the establishment of the Republican and Democratic parties. At that same time, to quell that, the Republican and Democratic parties are working to lock down electoral access even further. In Ohio, they've just passed a law making it very difficult for any third party or independent to get onto the ballot. Previously, the law, which had been very draconian, such as what has been passed, was struck down by the courts as being too draconian. And so the Libertarian Party has been growing because they've been able to run more candidates for office. They've been able to put their message out there. That's how you grow a party. Well, because John Kasich has done some things that have really made a lot of Tea Partiers very angry in the state of Ohio, and because one of the guys who was big in the Tea Party is now big in the Libertarian Party and has officially declared, when he declared he was running for governor of Ohio as a Libertarian, they rushed this bill through the legislature as an emergency provision, to make it so that it was much, much harder to get on the ballot. Now, that's not an emergency. That's just silliness. That's not an emergency. Emergency provisions are supposed to be for true emergencies, things like, oh, my gosh, we're out of money, or, oh, my gosh, half our state's underwater, or, oh, my gosh, half our state burned down. You understand what I'm saying? That's an emergency. They passed an emergency because they realize the Republicans in control of the legislature and the executive branches in Ohio, they realized that they're in trouble and that libertarians do pose a threat to them electorally, and therefore they're making it harder for libertarians to run, or anybody else, independents, greens, anybody. They want to lock it down to, you only get to choose between Democrats or Republicans. You end up with a fight over who's the worst and voting against the worst rather than voting is the best. Take a break here at the bottom. When we come back, we'll continue with this and then also some Obamacare stuff. Your calls are welcome at area code 858-683-1326, 858-683-1326. And when we return, we'll continue. Folks, stay tuned. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop, over 50 years, one source, one solution. ErniesPrintShop.com, 502-969-8585.
Just try to forget all this mess I'm in. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, I'm here with Brandon Simpson. He's the author of the new book, The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. And I guess start out with, what inspired you to write this book? What caused you to write this book?
First, I was going to write a book about my time in France. But every time I thought about it, I was going to write a book about how the French turned me into a libertarian. And then I thought, well, that's not going to work because people wouldn't want to read that, about a book about what it's like in France. Then I started to rethink the concept. How about how the French turned me into a libertarian, specifically geared towards libertarians? And then I couldn't stretch out into a whole book, though. And I thought, well, South Park. South Park is really, really libertarian. And then I thought, why not just do a libertarian analysis of South Park, and then I can use my experience from France to drive my point further.
Can you explain to us quickly what it was in France that turned you into a libertarian, since you brought it up?
Well, there's a really, really, a very large entitlement culture in France. They think they have a right to everything. And we had a lot of discussions about the differences between rights and privileges. And one thing that really shocked me about living in France was that smoking is not allowed in any businesses. And, you know, we all have this image of the French smoking everywhere, right? You can't smoke anywhere. And this is considered a conservative thing to do, to have smoking bans.
You said that you were thinking about writing the story about you turning into a libertarian and just kind of thinking about that in general, and then came upon the idea of the libertarian lessons of South Park. Kind of explain to me, you know, how you decided, and I know I've, you know, read through the book, and I haven't sat down and read it page to page yet, but I did obviously read a lot of it ahead of time. And explain to me, you know, you've got it broken down issue by issue, and I guess it would really be kind of episode by episode. So explain to us, I guess, what kind of led you down that path as far as setting the book up that way. And then also, well, I'll ask the second question when you get on with the first.
Okay, well, when I was trying to think of, like, how to approach these issues, I thought, well, it'd be easier if I do episode by episode first, then I would just take each episode and discuss each libertarian lesson in that. And some episodes only have, like, one little lesson, but in the beginning of the book, I have, like, the one about, you know, smoking bans, and that chapter has many issues, but I don't like to repeat myself in my books. That's why it's all there, but I keep on referring back to it later on.
Okay. And I guess then the question I was going to ask anyway was, what was your favorite chapter or favorite part or maybe favorite episode to write about?
I'd probably say the one called Butt Out, the one where they're you know, picking on Rob Reiner about being anti-smoking. That was one. And then my other one was probably Margaritaville. That was the one about the economic crisis in 2008.
I'm trying to remember if I remember that particular episode of Margaritaville. The one I remember clearly as far as economics go was the Goobacks.
Oh, yeah, Goobag. That was a good one, too. And I know that when I first saw it, I thought they sound more like conservative Republican when I first saw the episode. But when I listened to the commentary, Trey and Matt were just making fun of them. That's what they're saying. They're making fun of all these conservatives. They're saying, they took our jobs.
Yeah, and, you know, they do have a way of, with their particular type of satire, you know, getting a laugh by taking things to the extreme and taking people to their extreme. Yeah, it was kind of funny where towards the end of the episode they come upon the real answer that, hey, if we make things better now, you know, people won't want to come here or whatever, and you know, we can make a better future or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they end up saying, forget that, and
yeah,
we just go back to doing what we were doing.
Yeah.
So. It's kind of entertaining. Their comedy is definitely unique and one that is entertaining.
Another thing in that, I think I discussed, you know, the issue about, you know, how immigrants are supposedly taking people's jobs, and how they think English should be the official language. And I also discussed the issue of nationality, and I think nationality is a collectivist concept, and to me, that's not very libertarian. And then another thing I like to mention about, you know, these immigrants taking people's jobs, I'm thinking, are they really taking your jobs? They can't take your jobs. Only your employer can do that. And then on the issue of official languages, I mentioned that when I hear people say official language, I think they really mean mandatory language, which I think is also very anti-libertarian.
Right, and I, you know, not to deviate too far from the book, but I'm of German heritage, and from the Cincinnati, greater Cincinnati area, northern Kentucky is where I've grown up and where my family originally immigrated here from Germany. And, you know, before World War II, there were something like 12 German language newspapers. It was all German. And after World War I, there were still two of them that survived until World War II came along, and at that point, they shut down. But I guess whenever I get into a discussion about immigration with folks, one of the things I always try to point out is that we are a nation of immigrants. Basically, unless you're Native American, you're an immigrant of some sort. And even though some people came here willfully, some not, we're all immigrants. What is it that gives one person the right to say that another person can't come here so long as, and that's always kind of the big thing in the libertarian circles, is we don't want people coming here to leech off the system. We don't want them to come here just to get welfare, just to get benefits. But if somebody wants to come here and get a job and raise their family and make a better life for themselves, what's more American than that? That is the American experience, is coming from a horrible place and going for broke and making it. And that's what America was built on.
Completely agree there. I even cite Milton Friedman, who did say that. He said before 1914, immigration was good, but after 1914, immigration was suddenly bad. Before 1914, there was no welfare state, so we had good immigration.
I know there's a lot of controversy, even in libertarian circles, about the issue of immigration. You know, and unfortunately, there's court rulings and all kinds of different things on top of it that make it infinitely more complex to actually solve that problem. But I guess the point is that, and I hope everyone can agree, and I have run into some people that don't, but if someone wants to come here with the purpose of, you know, making a better life for themselves and coming and being an American, even though they hold on to some of that cultural heritage that they once had, I mean, it's entertaining, especially in the Cincinnati area, when people start complaining about, well, they're changing our culture. And I just have to laugh because there are so many little colloquialisms with Cincinnati and Cincinnati area in general. You know, in the Cincinnati area, when you want someone to repeat themselves, you say please, right? That's different than everywhere else in the U.S. And that's a carryover from a German slang, bitte, which means please, literally. But it was one of those things where they would say please when you would say, can you repeat yourself, please? The shorthand was please. So there's ways that German heritage has influenced the culture as well. And certainly one can't say that, you know, using the phrase please is in any way, shape, or form devastating to society. Certainly we have Oktoberfest, we have German festivals, and those aren't bad things. They're celebrations of German cultural heritage, but they're fun. And they don't hurt anyone. And likewise, we now have certain holidays that are based around Hispanic ideas. Cinco de Mayo, although there's some controversy around whether that's really a Mexican holiday, whatever. The point is, they're enhancements to our culture. When people come to America, the society tends to keep the things that they like about a culture, right? And they lose the things over time that they don't. And that's what I really believe that the melting pot really is.
True. I agree with that. I didn't know that the please from Cincinnati came from German. I wanted to go into linguistics, and that kind of fascinates me. Another thing I'd like to mention is something I wish I had written in the book before, but I didn't even think about it until, you know, recently, and that is Eric Cartman, the fat little kid. You know how he says, respect my authority in several episodes? I realize that every time that Matt and Trey are insulting or satirizing an authoritarian figure, Cartman is always on their side. And I guess they're trying to say that maybe authoritarians are fat little brats, like Eric Cartman is.
Well, and I think what it really is that they're trying to say that there are certain people, and maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, sometimes I think it's a little bit too much to overanalyze what's going on there. But I really think that a lot of it has to do with there are certain people that will just naturally fall in line with a status mindset, that there need to be rules, and the rules are good, and we need to have all these rules. And certainly I'm not an advocate for no rules at all. I mean, I'm a individual rights type of person that there's obviously rules involved in that. You don't hurt me, I don't hurt you. You know, those are rules,
sure.
But they're very basic and very fundamental rules. I feel like that there are people, as you say, like Cartman, who tends to fall in line with every authoritarian figure in the cartoon very, very quickly and jumps right on board because he's someone that jumps on a movement and is immediately seeking the power of that movement and at the same time wants that control and that authority, which is the whole respect my authority.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. In the episode of Butt Out, he said, wow, isn't he awesome, you guys? And he's like, what? Like, he just goes around imposing his will on people. He's my idol. And, of course, you know, Kyle is usually the only voice of reason among all four of them. Stan is sometimes, but not as much as Kyle is. And I think Cartman can't stand that.
No, and I think that's why he makes fun of Kyle all the time. So, you know, it's interesting. The lessons there in the stories are very, very interesting. And certainly I think it does a service that you've documented a number of those stories in the book. I'd like to find out from you, what was kind of the strongest lesson? What was the one that was to the person that may not be a libertarian, the person that isn't really paying attention? What's the number one lesson that probably smacked people that weren't paying attention upside the head and went, yeah, that's what it is? Do you think there's one in particular that stands out?
I think there might be one, and that was, I said that a dictatorship is a tyranny of the individual over the majority, and I said a democracy is just a tyranny of the majority over the individual. And you said in your radio show last week that a democracy is just a majority pushing around the minority, and that's exactly what it is. And they think that the majority rules and that the wisdom of the crowds means that it must be right. And they're saying, no, that's not always right.
One of the things we see in the business world, and I don't know if you've seen these or not, but the demotivational posters, the ones that make fun of the motivational posters, they're absolutely hilarious. And the one demotivational poster is meetings, because none of us are as dumb as all of us. And the point there being that groupthink can often lead to something worse than maybe just bouncing an idea off of one or two individuals, right, and having a good conversation. When you start dealing with the masses, and especially when you deal with a mass that is not really in tune with any particular issue that's being debated and is just listening to the media or listening to certain outlets that are pushing views rather than just reporting on them, that you end up with a mass of people that are easily manipulated and easily convinced to give up their own rights.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. There's another point that really drove home for one person. It was a libertarian from Canada. He told me that his favorite part of the book was how I kept, you know, tying everything back to freedom of choice. That was his favorite part of the book.
And I guess that's actually a really good question. Some of the folks that have already purchased the book, the feedback you're getting, I mean, it sounds like you're getting good feedback on it. I've seen some of the reviews. They all look really good. And I read those on Amazon, the reviews there. And, you know, it looks like everything's going real well. It looks like people are enjoying the book.
That's true. I've also been reaching out to libertarian organizations across the country. I've been contacting individual state libertarian parties. I don't even remember which ones I've got. I've got, I think, Colorado, New Mexico, Alabama, Michigan, Pennsylvania now just recently contacted me. And who else? Yeah, I think I'm forgetting one. Texas. Then I'm also reaching out to international libertarian parties, such as the Libertarian Party of the United Kingdom. Even the leader of the party commented in my book. So did Canada. Oh, yeah, by the way, the Libertarian Party leader of the United Kingdom, his name is Andrew Withers. In Canada, her name is Katrina Chown. Also, since I speak French and Spanish, I've been contacting this place, too. I found one in Belgium that started up 6 months ago. His name is Patrick Smet, or Smets. He speaks French, but his last name could be either French or Dutch, because he's from Belgium, so I'm not sure which one's which. So we've got Spain on board, Germany, Mexico, Argentina, and today I found two Irish sites, and I think they're called Liberal Ireland. This means classic liberal, not, you know, the modern liberal, and the other one's called Land of the Free, and it started up about 2 years ago, and it's probably the strongest libertarian Irish page there is on Facebook right now, and I think he told me they're trying to unite all the libertarian mind people under one banner.
That's always a strange and interesting feat. I know that from personal experience. But, yeah, obviously, I guess that's actually another good benefit of you being multilingual, is that you're able to reach out not just to English-speaking people, but also Spanish and French, which covers a good portion of the world, other than possibly Asia and some Eastern European countries. I think you've pretty much got it covered.
When I contacted these parties, I realize they started up after Ron Paul ran for president in 2008 or after he ran for president in 2012, and apparently he was the reason they became parties. Even the Party of Reason in Germany, they're the Libertarian Party, but they call themselves the Party of Reason. They started up because of Ron Paul, and they actually have a page devoted to Ron Paul, and they translate everything he says into German. Now, as far as Asia is concerned, I couldn't find any libertarian Asian sites. I went to the Amazon China, because there's an international Amazon site, and I see how my book is doing, and if it's available or not, and make sure all the title is correct, because that can be a problem when it's going international. Like, is the title correct? Because a lot of times it's not, and I had to go, hey, this isn't right. So when I went to China, this book was not even showing up, and I'm thinking they must be banning it or something.
Yeah, and, you know, that wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, really, the Asian cultures in general are very, very different than Western culture. Just a whole different approach on life in general, and that's something better suited for a philosophy class in the show. But you've got quite a reach into the Western world, I guess I should say, and that's a good thing. I hope that more people read the book. I hope that they hand it off to their South Park-loving friends that maybe aren't so political, maybe aren't really thinking about it. And I think that that can have a good long-term impact on the libertarian, small-L libertarian movement in general.
Yeah, that's why I chose South Park, because I thought South Park was much more appealing to a broader audience, because I thought I can get, you know, both libertarians and South Park fans to read this. And South Park fans in general, I think when they watch the show, they become more and more libertarian. Or maybe they watch the show because they are libertarian, or maybe they're libertarian because they watch the show. I'm thinking it could be a little bit of both. If this book does well, I have plans to do more. And the next one will be about Star Wars.
The Libertarian Lessons of Star Wars, huh? So, well, folks, I guess if we want to see the Libertarian Lessons of Star Wars, then we need folks to go out and buy this book, The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. Tell us how we can get a copy of it.
You can go to Amazon.com and do a search for The Libertarian Lessons of South Park, or you can go to my site, libertarianforronpaul.com. There's a link on the right-hand side.
All right, well, Brandon, I want to thank you a lot for coming on the show, and I certainly appreciate it. I mean, anytime we can promote the small L libertarian message in general, that's really why activists like myself and others are involved in all these groups, like the Libertarian Party, Campaign for Liberty, and a number of other organizations. And the more people that we can convince that we're right, the further we're going to go and the better off I think society will be as a whole when we all learn to leave each other alone. Any other parting thoughts?
One thing, I did mention that I was reaching out to small L libertarians in this book, not just big L libertarians, and I did make a distinction between that. I said I'm reaching out to small L libertarians because they reach everybody, not just the big L libertarians.
Well, good deal, and folks, check out The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. The author is Brandon Simpson, spelled exactly how it sounds, and certainly thank you for coming on the show. Again, thanks, Brandon, and folks, we'll be right back.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. We're here every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time, and we do appreciate when people call in, and we do have some callers. We've got co-host Dave who joins the show, and Paul returns, so I'm going to bring them back on here. Guys, I want to talk about the McConnell-Bevin race because, you know, this has been quite a bit of media, obviously, and a lot of money, you know, a lot of outside money. And that's, you know, getting back to that $100 million that they're talking about for this race, most of the money is coming from out of state. And for that matter, in the primary, most of the money has come from out of state. I don't know. I'm interested in your all's thoughts. Or do you have any handicapping on this? Paul, let's let you go first.
Well, being a Jefferson County resident, we get a vast amount of advertising to the local media. And also being an independent, I don't have a dog in this fight, but right now I think Matt has gotten some awfully bad advice all along the way in terms of his campaign advisors. He's been just recently running some ads he actually should have started off with, and that is an ad that I'll classify as a, you know, get to know me kind of an ad. He just now started running those kinds of ads, which is amazing. You know, those kinds of ads you should run at the beginning, you know, when you launch. But he's just terribly outspent. He doesn't have the network. He has been tagged with a whole bunch of labels that he just hasn't been able to shake. I'm going to be surprised if there isn't a 20 to 30 point win by McConnell in that race. I'm gonna be shocked if it isn't that large.
All right, I'm writing it down. 20 to 30 points. Dave, what are your thoughts?
honestly, my thoughts about the McConnell-Bevin race, it just I'm flabbergasted. That's the way to describe my feelings on that race. I cannot believe. I can't believe that anybody's going to vote for McConnell. But, I mean, I know it's going to happen, right? You know, but every time I hear it and I see the numbers and everything, I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah.
And the other, yeah, and, you know, to be fair, I don't know that much about Bevin. The one thing that keeps cropping up, you know, that I see about Bevin is that McConnell attack ad about, you know, Bevin's alleged, you know, activity in cockfighting, right?
Right.
And so that, when every time I see that, I have the biggest belly laugh. You know, it works out to my favor. I mean, it's probably making me a little bit younger because I'm getting so many laughs, you know, about it. But I keep thinking, you know, this is an attack ad from McConnell, who, you know, is running for the position that he's been in for a while. And his allegation is that Bevin was, you know, allegedly involved in cockfighting. And that is exactly the job that McConnell has done in his position. And he's running for it again. But he's got an attack ad out negatively saying that he's, you know, that Bevin, his challenger, is involved in cockfighting.
Like, yeah.
How does this not work out in his favor with your audience?
Well, and so I actually agree 100% with both of you guys. I think Bevin had an opportunity. I think he stumbled from the gate, had slow momentum, started to pick up steam, made a mistake, momentum stopped. Then the national groups jumped in, started supporting him. He got some momentum, went to a cockfighting rally, and the momentum stopped. I think it's unfortunate for him. I know there's a lot of good people that I know personally that have been supporting Bevin. And, you know, it's nothing against them or anything that they've done. But I think you're right, Paul. I think this race is over. And I'm thinking it's a 20-point race personally.
I like Dave's point about the cockfighting comparison. Kind of reminds me of a few years ago when a statewide office holder by the name of Jack Conway decided that he was going to try to sully the reputation of Rand Paul with the Aqua Buddha thing. And we saw that just absolutely did not work. In fact, in many cases, I think it probably backfired on Jack. And I think that Aqua Buddha thing is going to be draped around Jack's neck in the next election cycle for the next office he's chosen to run for. So it should be fun.
Yeah, that's a whole other race. I mean, the gubernatorial race, all the executive branch stuff starts next year, so we get to do silly season all over again. Dave, did you have any prediction numbers-wise on McConnell Bevin, or do you just want to stay out of that?
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that I do have is an extreme amount of faith in the human capability of change, you know, to the positive. And so I'm going to say that McConnell's going to win by about 8 points.
All right. We got Dave down here at 8 points.
I have more faith in humanity than you guys do, I guess.
You have more faith in Republican primary voters, I guess, anyway. So, it just amazes me. Everybody, he's got a 60% unfavorability rating, yet he's going to be the Republican nominee, which, you know, is dangerous for Republicans, I think, because the last person to run with a 60% unfavorability rating was David Williams in the 2011 race. And surprise, surprise, he lost by about 20 points. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting race to watch all the way through. You know, and I hope my friends that are listening that are Bevin supporters don't think I'm doing this as a knock on Bevin. I just, you know, just my honest analysis, you know. And I would be surprised but it would probably be a pleasant surprise, I guess, if things turn out a little differently.